You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet, and story is everything. We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell.
And we're delighted that you're with us again this evening. That was our opening music, the Hot Texas Swing Band's Hot Texas. We're so delighted to start our show tapping our toes. Who's with us tonight?
We have a special guest, Pat Waller.
Yes, Pat Waller is with us. Hey, Pat. Hi.
Good to see you.
Oh, it's so fun to be face-to-face, almost like we were in a conference room together.
Yeah, exactly. And I love your opening music. It had me snapping my fingers.
Great.
They're a wonderful Texas swing band. Wonderful, wonderful. And we just love them. So yeah, you can never have a bad, you know, moment when you're listening to Western swing. It just, you can't, you know, it just makes you smile. Well, we are delighted that you're with us. We're going to be talking about two books this evening. The one that we'll probably talk about in greater detail is your newest book, The Rose of Washington Square, a novel of Rose O'Neill, creator of the Cupid doll. And we're hoping that we're going to have enough time, but we have so much to talk about. This is a great, great book. Also, I Am Mrs. Jesse James are the two books that Pat Waller has written that we'll talk about tonight. Do you want to tell us a little bit about Pat?
We have a little bio for our audience. Pat Waller is a winner of Western Fictionaire's Best First Novel of 2018. She's also a Walter Williams Award winner and the winner of Author Circle Awards 2019 Novel of Excellence in Historical Fiction for her debut novel, I Am Mrs. Jesse James. A frequent contributor to the Chicken Soup for the Soul anthologies, Pat is an avid reader with a special passion for historical fiction, women's fiction, and stories with heart. She makes her home in Missouri with her husband and two rescue critters, one feisty peek-a-boo pup, and a tabby cat with an oversupply of attitude. Welcome, Pat.
Thank you. I love being here. What fun.
It's fun. And so when your next novel comes out, you know you're going to need to be here.
Oh, right? Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm ready. If I ever get it written.
Oh, I know it's in the works.
It helps.
I know it's in the works. So why don't we just kind of get started a little bit, Pat. Tell us a little bit more about yourself and maybe when you started writing.
Sure. Well, I've lived in Missouri really my entire life. Mm-hmm. So lifelong resident. I live in the St. Louis metropolitan area. And I live, as you mentioned in the bio, with my family and with two rescue pups that are kind of, I keep looking at the dog, hoping he's not going to bark. The cat is banned from the room. So hopefully all will be well. But we'll see what happens. This is live.
It is.
You know, you
yes,
never know what's going to happen.
You don't.
We don't edit anything out after. It's live and it becomes available seconds after it ends. So, yeah.
So, education-wise, I have a bachelor's degree in sociology and a master's degree in nonprofit management. I worked for decades in my career as a juvenile officer, which was a fascinating job, of course. Everything new every day. There was never a dull moment. And then the last, I would say, about 5 years that I was there before I retired, I was the grant manager, which meant that I did a lot of writing because I did grant applications, which requires a lot of both research and writing. So it was kind of a good prep for for writing historical novels. And I would say, starting the writing portion of my life, really that kind of went on off and on throughout decades, I would say. I always like to tell this story. The very first time was in Reader's Digest. I had submitted All in a Day's Work. I had submitted a little short piece for that and didn't think anything more of it. Well, lo and behold, they bought it and published it. So that was my very first publication in Reader's Digest.
Great. And
one of the things I got was a nice check and a bumper sticker that read, "I found fame and glory. Reader's Digest bought the story."
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, I was pretty stoked. It was pretty exciting stuff. But basically, mostly what I did was just sending small little pieces here or there, and I might get in an anthology or in a small circulation magazine or a newsletter, things like that. But I think when things really changed is when I started getting involved in writing groups, and that made all the difference. You know, you're learning the craft because there is a lot of craft to writing. It's not just, hey, I think I'll write a book. So that was very helpful. And also something that's really, really helpful for every writer is to make connections with other writers. The thing that you get when you're in writers groups is you can't put a price tag on it. It's really, really important.
So did you discover that you were an outliner or a pantser?
Oh, I am so definitely an outliner. As you can see in preparation for this, I have pages and pages of notes just in case I need them. But yeah, I could no more just sit down and write a coherent story then I could grow wings and fly. There's just no way. I have to. Now I will say, I don't know if this makes me a plantser, but I do the outline, and but if as I'm writing things change, I don't go, well, I have to stick to this outline. I am more than ready if my characters are telling me something that's important to incorporate that and maybe adjust a little bit what my original outline was. So I will do that, but I have to start. I have to know where I'm starting, where I'm ending up, and some at least potential steps on how I'm going to get from point A to point B.
I know you have a question.
You do?
I do.
I was just thinking, you've been from Missouri and you are in Missouri right now. Do you write where you are, right, where you're speaking, or do you work someplace else?
Oh, I would say that almost always I write from my laptop, sitting in a recliner, or at my desk, but always from home. I kind of envy people that can go into a coffee shop or whatever and open their laptop and just start typing away. I cannot do that. I have to have silence or I get distracted. Like if I was in a coffee shop and people were talking, I'd be listening to them talk. I wouldn't be writing anything.
There might be a story there.
That's true.
In what they're talking about, you know?
That's true. There is that, because you could pick up some good story ideas, but I just can't seem to multitask in that way. I have to really be concentrating on what I'm doing. And unfortunately, the least little distraction and I'm oh, really? What's going on over there? So, yeah.
So you probably, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying, do you ever work on a real tight schedule, or are you kind of free form? Do you work in the morning and evening, or when it's all comes to you?
I haven't written much lately. Well, since the second book came out, I really have not written, other than a one little short piece that I've been working on. I have not written, basically, back to the I cannot seem to multitask. So if I'm wearing my writing hat, that's what I have to do. The research hat, that's what I got to do. Marketing hat, that's what I've got to do. However, I need to start thinking about the next book, and I've gathered some materials to kind of help me along the way. But right now I've been marketing and trying to get the word out about this book.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it just came out. Right. Remind us, when did
it come
out?
The end of January.
End of January. Okay. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Both of these books are about really, really interesting, somewhat independent. Well, definitely Rose O'Neill, very independent. And to a degree, Mrs. Jesse James as well. Two really remarkable women, and you write them in the first person. Tell us a little bit about why you like to write in the first person.
Well, I like to not only read, but also write biographical historical fiction. And I feel like that woman is telling the story. So it made perfect sense to do it in first person because it's her story. It's not my story. I'm just channeling her to write what she wants me to write. So I always do first person. Plus, I think that creates a much closer relationship between the reader and the character when you write in first person, because you are in their head. You know what they're thinking. You know what they want. You know what their goals and obstacles are. I mean, if you are pretty much living the story with that character.
Mm-hmm. In the I am Mrs. Jesse James. For any of our listeners or watchers, if you have any kind of an interest in Jesse and this time of history, this is really a remarkable book because Mrs. Jesse James doesn't know very much about what her husband is up to because he protects her that way. Mm-hmm. And so because it's first person, we only know what she knows. That's and true. She only knows what Jesse tells her or what she might catch in a headline of something. And to me, that was so interesting because I, as a reader, kept thinking, okay, now what year was that? Now, all right, so was that train robbery or was that stagecoach? And we only get the one clue with the word Northfield in that one incident. And so that kind of makes it a little bit of a mystery, too, for the reader. And maybe wanting to go find out what were each one of those incidences that were happening.
Yeah, he did try to keep her. Accounts I read from people that actually were part of his gang, those who survived, said that he never told her anything. He didn't want her to know. However, I will say she heard all the rumors. She saw newspaper headlines. And to be honest, I think she also, the newspapers of the day, anytime any kind of a crime happened that might be similar to the Jesse James style, they said, oh, Jesse James and his gang did this. And I know not all of them were correct. And I'm sure she hung on to that. It's like, well, he was here. I know he didn't, or whatever. So, but she had to know all of the rumors and all of the talk, and she saw the newspapers, and she had to make her own assumptions about that. And I know she believed that he was at heart a good man.
Yeah.
He wouldn't have stayed.
Yes. How did you meet Rose O'Neill?
Well, after doing a 3-book contemporary romance series, I wanted to go back to historicals because that's really my first love. And I kind of thought I really would like to do another woman who had ties to Missouri. So I started researching, looking for women who had some sort of a tie to my home state. And ran across, probably there were 4 different women that I thought, these are all interesting and they're not well known and they've done things that are important. But as I read, the more I learned about Rose, the more I became convinced she needed to be the person that I would write about. She accomplished so many things. And at one time she was probably one of the most famous women in the world. Yeah. And now, I think I had mentioned when we talked before, I would go into a room of other writers or of just a group of people and ask, hey, what do you know about Rose O'Neill? And the answer was always nothing. They had no clue who she was. And then I would mention, well, do you know anything about the Kewpies? And a lot of people didn't, especially the younger ones. But a couple would say, yeah, I remember. I know about the Kewpies. But they didn't associate Rose with the Kewpies. Mm-hmm. Plus, there were so many other things, as I said, that she did that went above and beyond the Kewpies. I thought, you know, she deserves a story. She needs to be brought back to the public's attention. She deserves that. So she became the next subject of a biographical historical fiction piece.
We're going to take a very short break to let our listeners know where they can pick up both of these books. And so, Pat, stay right where you are. We're going to be right back with author Pat Waller in just a moment. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu. Choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer with special guest Pat Waller.
Yes.
And we're holding up a book.
We can't multitask. We've been talking about the main character, the narrator and storyteller of her own story in The Rose of Washington Square, a novel of Rose O'Neill, creator of The Kewpie Doll. And I know you have some, we want to know more about Rose. You have some questions.
Well, first, what's the time period for Rose here when we get her started?
Well, she left her home and her family in 1893 and went to New York. Mm. And that was quite a brave thing to do. Mm-hmm. She went by herself. I mean, her parents, as the story goes, they sold the family cow because they did not have money. And they sold the family cow to help give her the funds to go to New York. And something I thought was fascinating was her father, who was the dreamer of the family. I think of her parents as glitter and glue. Her dad was the glitter,
dreamer.
That we're going to do all of these wonderful things. And her mother, that they called Mimi, was the glue. She's the one that held the family together. Mm-hmm. And she was the practical person. But in any event, they scraped together the money to send her to New York City, where they hoped she was a self-educated artist. She had no less formal lessons. Mm. She learned, as she reported herself, she learned by copying figures from her papa's numerous stacks of books. He was a bookseller, and there were books everywhere in their home. As a young woman of 19 traveled to New York. Now, her father did make arrangements for her to stay in the St. Regis Convent in New York, and that's the base from which she operated, taking her illustrations and going from editor's office to editor's office, trying to sell her work, which was not easy. For one, she didn't have the credentials that the male artist did, and the other thing was she was female, and this was a male-dominated world.
It was.
Mm-hmm. Yes, in fact, they didn't want her to use her name.
Correct. Yeah. Initially, she was allowed to sign. She wanted to sign her full name, but what she ended up having to do was on her the pieces that she did eventually sell. Now that changed later on, but at the beginning they thought it might be offensive to their readers to find out that she was a woman. Mm-hmm. So she had to sign just O'Neill.
Mm-hmm. Did she like corsets?
She did not. She did not. Now, she wore them for a while, but as her fame grew and her fortune along with it, she soon abandoned the idea. And in fact, she was an advocate for a lot of different things. Or if it was a cause that was important to her, she was an advocate for it. And one of those things was women should not be fettered. They should not be in a harness. She called them harnesses. How can they possibly succeed in the things that they want to do if, with a career or anything else, if they're tied up like that? When men don't have to be, why should women have to be? So she was an early advocate also for dressing in a much more comfortable fashion than what was the norm for young women of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found it kind of interesting. She goes in, she must be really, really good at making a business presentation, because she goes into those offices at first and they pretend like she's not even there. They don't even acknowledge her. And she finally, after a while.
Well, you have to remember, too, that at the beginning, she went into these offices arrangements accompanied by two nuns who were in their full garb. And it had to be at least an attention getter. But her father had made those arrangements because he didn't want her wandering around the city by herself. But yeah, I think she presented herself well. But most of all, she was persistent.
She didn't give up
when there were doors closed in her face. She didn't give up. She was determined that she was going to make money, not only to support herself, but her family. She wanted to help them as well. Mm-hmm. So that was really what drove her, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was the breadwinner for a total extended family. She did. Mm-hmm. She supported a lot of people. She all the families. She sent them to school.
Yep, she did. She and her brother, as you find out later in the novel, had mental health issues that at the time, you know, they couldn't really do much about except put them in an institution for a while. And she funded all of that. Anytime he had a stay, she paid for it. She had a heart for, you know, not just for taking care of her family, but for other creatives, because she knew how much she had struggled in her, at the beginning of her career. And so she wanted to lend a helping hand to others. She even endowed a table at a restaurant.
That's wonderful.
That if an artist ate there and could not afford to pay the bill, she paid it for them. Mm-hmm. So she was very generous in that way.
For sure.
There's a property in the book that grows as the book goes along. And Jim kind of referred to it one time as Shangri-La. It has a real name. Tell us a little bit about Bonnybrook and how that property came to be.
Yeah, her father had read, he was a well-read man, and he read Thoreau, and he was just determined to find his own wilderness, his own Walden's Pond, and he would drag his family from place to place. Well, he basically found this property. I think at the time it was between 100 and 200 acres originally, and homesteaded it. It had a dog trot cabin on the property when they moved into it, which is basically two cabins that are connected by a breezeway. Pretty rough. I mean, I've seen a sketch she did of the interior of one of the cabins, and it was definitely not big. It was not spacious, and it was just very roughly hewn wood log walls and, you know, a bucket sitting here and supplies sitting there. So yeah, it was very rough. But one of the things that she achieved success that she wanted to do was build a real home for her family there. And she loved Bonnybrook. Yeah. She felt like it was a place of inspiration for her. So they started on that process and they built it a floor at a time as the money came along to do it.
And each time she goes home, it seems it's kind of fun to see through her eyes. you, her, you know, channeling her, each time she goes back, she right away notices, oh, there's this improvement, or oh, there's balconies now, or oh, there's the wide wraparound porch kind of in the front. And
you know, this is where mom comes into play, because she's a construction manager.
Yeah, her mom.
Yeah, this is where she's
a really interesting family. It's a very talented family, and the mom and the dad aren't always living together. The dad, you know, he has his, but they're a very functional family. You'd think that they're not, and they're highly, highly functional and great respect and love for each other. But where does the dad go? What's the name of the place the dad goes?
Well, he went many places, and it was always he was selling subscriptions or he was selling books, although he never seemed to sell that many books. One of the places that I mentioned there here, which is where he went after Bonnybrook. Bonnybrook is in the middle of the complete wilderness. I mean, it's like it takes a couple of days from Springfield to get from Springfield in Missouri to Bonnybrook. So it was hardly in the middle of civilization.
Right.
But he at some point felt like it was just not wild enough for him. It was just too civilized. And so he ends up finding a property in Arkansas called Hemden Holler.
Hemden Holler,
right.
Which was it was at the foot of a waterfall. Mm. And you had to hike like 5 miles from the main trail in order to get to it. And that's where he went. They had a very unorthodox relationship in that. And a lot of times the hill folk in Bonnybrook thought it was just appalling that the father just left Mimi there all the time and was off wandering around. They just could not understand that, but it worked for the two of them. She was happy. She was just as happy to see him come back as she was to see him go, apparently. So, they were content with the way that they did things. So, interesting.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about her love life?
We need probably move on to our first interest here, Gray Latham. She meets pretty quickly when she gets into New York.
Yeah, she actually had met him.
That's right.
A year prior, roughly. He was traveling, selling pharmaceuticals, and he was in Nebraska, where at that time is where her family was. And they met, and there was a bit of a connection. They exchanged letters for a while afterward and just then happened to run into each other in New York City, and they basically reestablished that relationship, and it began to deepen into affection, friendship to affection to love, and they ended up marrying.
Mm-hmm. They did.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. And during all of that time, her career is really blossoming. Mm-hmm. His career is not quite so blossoming, but it's amazing to me that she still was able to send money home, considering his lack of understanding what to do with her money.
Well, as Rose phrased it, he did not understand the difference between mine and thine. And I think that pretty much summed it up. I think he began to feel, my personal take on it is, when they married, he was wrapped up in, they were going to do this amazing projector idea. And
that's right.
Because at the time, the kinetoscopes where you would just look through the, you know, through the little viewer and see an individual thing at a time, they wanted to project onto a screen. And actually his father, who was also he developed what they call the Latham Loop, which from what I understand is still used today. But in any event, he had big plans for that. And that all fell apart because of lawsuits that were going on about copyright and so on and so forth. So I think that pushed him a little farther into the inclination of, you know, my wife is making all of this money. Why should I worry about it? You know, I'll just have fun spending it.
So, well, she did.
Yes, she very much so did. And Rose forgave him many times, but there reaches the point where you're done. And she eventually reached that point.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, what were some of the publications that her illustrations were being found in at the time?
Well, she did. She illustrated for Truth Magazine. In fact, in Truth Magazine was published the very first, supposedly the very first comic strip created by a woman was published in Truth Magazine. Mm-hmm. It was called The Old Subscriber Calls, which was kind of an interesting, I think it was three or four panels, but it was the bottom line of the story was a subscriber is angry over price increase or something. He comes to the office and gives the editor what for, and they end up in a fist fight. And after that, the editor is his secretary is like, "Oh my gosh, are you all right?" And the editor is like, "Oh, it's all okay. I was afraid he was coming to cancel his subscription." Because you know we need those subscribers.
So. That sounds like a cartoon that could a strip that could run now.
Yes, it does. Does indeed. But yeah, that was hers, and that was the first woman comic illustration.
Mm-hmm. So do you want to ask about the QP?
Well, what's Puck Magazine? Where she really got her neck, you know, where she really moved, I guess, moved forward in her career.
Yeah, she had gained a lot of success. She had she had jobs everywhere. She didn't turn down a job anywhere. She freelanced everywhere. And Puck Magazine eventually offered her a job as on their staff. Mm-hmm. And she accepted, of course, because it was pretty impressive to have that happen. The entire staff was male. She was the only female on the on the art staff. So it was a pretty exciting moment for her. Mm-hmm. And that was, things just continued to go from there, continued to get bigger and better from there.
Mm-hmm. So where does Cupie come in?
Well, Rose had a way of, back then novels were illustrated. They're unlike today's world. That was part of a novel. You expected to see an illustration from time to time in the novel. And she did a lot of book illustrations. If she was doing a romantic scene, let's say for a novel, she would add little Cupid looking creatures around the corners, just as a decorative element. And in some of her other work, it would appear too. And the editor at Ladies Home Journal, which was another place she freelanced at, said, "You know, what do you think about putting that into a comic strip? And I'll find a writer that can tell the story of what you illustrate." And Rose had a pretty adamant opinion on that. Her opinion was, "I can do the verses myself." Now, by this time, she'd published a novel because she also wrote. She published novels. She published poetry. So she said, "Do not," in the letter she wrote to him, "do not doubt me." In other words, "I can do this." And sure, gave her the chance. And that was the real beginning for the Cupies, because people loved the comic and it became something they couldn't get enough of.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in all of the time that you were researching, there's so much. This book is just, again, we're talking about the Rose of Washington Square, and she goes to Europe. She meets every important playwright and author and artist, and quite a life, a remarkable life. And she's not intimidated by any of that. Also, it's just, that's just the world she's moving around in. What you had to do a lot of research. Was there anything that surprised you as you got to know her that you were not expecting to find?
I would say I had a fairly good grasp on the main points in her life. But what I will say is that one of the things I love, love, love about historical fiction, and there are many things I love, but one of them is when you're digging into deeper into things and you run across items that you haven't seen anywhere else. I had read quite a few books that are published about Rose and articles, and I saw neither of two of the things I found out of during my research anyplace else. One was the fact that she apparently had been engaged to be married the year before she left Nebraska for New York. I happened to run in a genealogy site. I ran across an application for a marriage certificate. And I was like, I've never heard anybody mention this. And it was to a man named Charles Berenger. She didn't mention it in her autobiography either. So I'm like digging into it, thinking, what on earth could have happened? Well, I finally realized the way they did the application was the application was filled out, the top part. The bottom part, once the wedding took place, would be filled out to confirm the marriage had taken place. The bottom part was blank.
Okay.
So what that meant was something happened to break this engagement.
Exactly. Which
nobody could say what that was because nobody even had mentioned that information. So that gave me the ability as a novelist to come up with a reason why that engagement didn't happen. So that was fun. And then I also ran across a lawsuit that was interesting where her marketing agent for the Cupies sued her because he felt he should be getting more royalties, that some of it was being diverted to other places. So he sued her. So Rose promptly countersued him, and they had quite a battle apparently. But yeah, it was, those are the kind of things that are gold for a writer. If you run across something that nobody else has written about, it's like, oh yeah, this is why we do
a little detective work going on there.
Yeah.
We're going to take another very quick break. And when we come back, let's talk a little bit about what went into the launch of this book, since I was part of the launch team. We'll be back in a moment.
Here at the Out West Shop, we're passionate about the American West, the truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods. We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western lifestyle. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. We round it up and bring it to you. Check out OutWestShop.com when you need anything Western.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer with special guest Pat Waller. And we're talking about Rose of Washington Square.
I'm still challenged getting things in the camera correctly. There we go. So, Pat, it was so fun, you know, partly because of this radio show and doing things on our Facebook page and our Instagram page and connecting with other authors and some that we have in common. I happened to come across an invitation to join a launch team for this book. And because we're not writers, we're readers only, I thought, oh, I'm always trying to understand a little bit more about the writer's world. And I thought, oh, wouldn't that be interesting to be part of a launch team and sort of learn what goes on? So would you take a few moments and tell us a little bit about how this book got launched and what did some of the team members do?
Well, this is the very first time that I ever used a launch team. So it was a learning experience for me. In fact, I'm going to try and refer to my notes a little bit because it's been so long since I thought about it. But it is a lot of work, I will say that. I, for the first time, had a launch team leader, I guess is what you would call her, who kind of managed it. And she kind of also taught me what I needed to be doing. And then she did a lot of things too. So we kind of worked together. The first task was to recruit launch team members. So that meant going out on social media, newsletter, so on and so forth, to find people who would be willing to do certain things, one of which was to share graphics that the launch team leader would create, and that would be like once or twice a week. There would be graphics to share. And then to on the what the, she called the power purchase day would purchase a book, either paperback or ebook. Mm-hmm. And after the launch was over, it would actually post reviews on the book were the three main things. And in return, they would get a copy of the PDF for the book. So they would get an advanced reader copy of the book. They would have a chance to win prizes. We did drawings every week, sometimes drawing a week, did a grand prize drawing at the end. And they would also receive swag related to the book. Like I think we did bookmarks, postcard. Mm-hmm. We did a little screen cleaner thing that was in a clear plastic package that had the book's name and my website on it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it was fun, but I will say it was a whole bunch of work. And thank goodness I had a launch team manager because I would never, I mean, literally I will, here's the schedule.
Yeah. Yeah.
The hell of things that went on every week during that launch.
And some of what you're describing, I mean, we as the launch team, we knew it was going to start on such a date, but you and your launch team manager creating the product, you must have had a timeline that started, you know, way before, okay, we're ready to launch. You had to have had those things created and ready to be able, you know, to ship, and what kinds of questions. I think there was some trivia, fun trivia questions, and you might have blogged a little bit during. We learned a little bit more about characters and things. You really kept the team very interested. It was more than just read and review, because you also wanted us to be sharing. The whole power of social media is sharing and getting other people, you know, excited. I don't want to put you on the spot, but did you get some of the results you were hoping for?
I would say yes. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that was my launch team leader really, I mean, she's a very dynamic person and very helpful, and she kept me on track. And I think she tried to keep the launch team on track as well, in terms of, you know, let's do this. You know, she was very cheerleader, which is what you have to be for something like that, I think. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I would say it got a fair amount of reviews right after the launch completed. It also, on the Power Purchase Day, one of the reasons she has what she calls the Power Purchase Day, which is to get people to buy either the ebook or paperback on the same day, is to shake up the Amazon algorithms and make the book rise in ranks. So it
very maybe, smart.
Yeah, yeah, so it will maybe hit the bestseller list. Yeah.
Right.
And we ended up in our category, we hit number 15. Which I've had books hit higher than that, but for a brand new book, I thought that was pretty good. Not to mention the fact that it was an extremely competitive category. And it also, there were a boatload of brand new releases that week that were historical fiction. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of competition. So I was not too unhappy with it being number 15. Mm-hmm.
Sure. I remember seeing a post from her, and it was kind of late in the day, but she said, we need one more review to get to a first threshold of 25. Mm-hmm. And I looked at my watch, and I don't typically write reviews. I just kind of don't have the time I really should. I know how much they help authors, and we read a book a week. We should be doing a little review every week. But I thought, you know, I'm going to go ahead. I'm going to do this right now. And I wrote it and got it in, and I made the deadline. And I think right away she said, thank you. You know, we just hit 25. And then I think a couple more people filed reviews like later that evening. And you were so kind because you were very involved. I saw you thanking people through all of this. You were acknowledging and liking and thanking. And I thought, oh, you must be spending all of your just trying to follow.
It's labor intensive for those few weeks, for sure. Yeah, there has to be a lot of interaction with the launch team, because I do appreciate the fact that people are doing that, because it is very helpful. And interestingly, after it was all over, I was at a couple of different author events where other authors said to me, you know, I was seeing your stuff everywhere, which was cool. It was there like, oh, man, yay.
It works.
Oh, my gosh. We're at 45 minutes. Honey, do you have a question that you want to ask Pat? Because we are going to have to wrap up. Oh, my goodness.
It's been fun.
It's been so fun.
We have fun. We have time for a writer's tip. Do you have a tip for any folks out there that are writing or thinking about it? Or
I give you two tips. One is find a writer group, find your tribe that will be invaluable to you. And number two, don't sit too much or your back will make you very, very sore.
Very good.
That's really good. And what are you working on next? Or maybe you're not ready to share that.
Well, not ready to share it yet, but it may end up being a fictional character this time, which is a conglomeration of real characters that I'm going to put into one. We'll see how it turns out.
Well, we'd love to be considered advanced readers for you.
Oh, yay.
We'll figure out how to get another, you know, book read. Don't go away. We're so delighted that you're with us. Oh, I know. Quickly, where else can people, they know they can get it through our site, but where else can people get your book?
Probably best way, go to my website, www.patwaller.com.
And we are talking about The Rose of Washington Square. And I just inhaled this book too. I am Mrs. Jesse James. Yeah. Let's see, Jim, next week we are actually attending a writer's conference. We are going to Western Writers of America. We'll be in Rapid City, South Dakota. We're really looking forward to it. So our good friend, award-winning poet Tom Swearingen, is stepping in again to be the host next week. And his featured guest is an award-winning singer, songwriter, and author, John Chandler. I'm almost really sorry we're not going to be here to talk to John. And they'll be talking about his book, Wyoming Wind, a novel of Tom Horn, and The Spanish Peaks, a novel of Frontier Colorado. So that's next week. And then we're back on the 29th, and we'll be talking to internationally best-selling authors. They are a team that write together, Andrews and Wilson, and we will be talking about their latest book, Dempsey, which is a thriller, espionage, you know, all that kind of. Jim can't wait to start reading this book. And that will be back here on the 29th. And do you have a quote?
We have two quotes. I thought this first one was very apropos to both Rose and her father, and it's Henry David Thoreau. If a man does not keep pace with his companions, perhaps it is because he hears a different drummer. Let him step to the music which he hears, however measured and far away. Now, from Rose O'Neill herself, and she's quoting from Shakespeare.
She liked to quote Shakespeare.
And this is to Gray Latham, her first husband, but before they were married. She says, "Sir, if music be the food of love, play on." And this is said at the Waldorf Astoria in 1893.
Oh, such a great place. Well, thank you, Pat, again for being with us. We've been talking with Pat Waller, and we've been talking about her two books, The Rose of Washington Square. You will want to read this. These are not for women reader only. Jim, I absolutely enjoyed these books. So, gentlemen, if you're watching, these are for you too. And thank you again, Pat, for being with us. And thank you
so much for letting me be here. It was fun.
It was really fun.
It was fun.
Thanks to Sam Hassan of LA Talk Radio and, of course, the Hot Texas Swing Band. And what else?
Remember, it's always a great day out west.
Keep reading and keep writing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell only.